The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
The Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show.
Hey folks, Bob here. Don't just see Peter Pan Live, let it surround you. Peter Pan Live in the 360 Theater, now playing in the D.C. area on the biggest surround CGI theater stage in the world. Find out more at peterpan360.com and keep listening. In just a few minutes, we'll tell you how you can enjoy this amazing experience for up to 50% less.
Recorded live in the USA and covering the whole wide world, this is the Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show.
Right on!
With Bob Seska and Chez Pazienza.
This here's a 2008 Dodge Stratus. It's got some gears in there and a steering wheel, and I've outfitted the roof with a vinegar spritz and cannon to dissipate chemtrails while I drive. I'm Alex Jones, and this is Crazies in Cars Getting Conspiracies. We're here in Newport, Rhode Island, to talk conspiracies with my sidekick at Infowars.com, Mr. Dan Bedondi.
Hello, this is Dan Bedondi from TruthRadioShow.com.
Dan, Alex Jones.
Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Hello?
Dan, I think you're holding the phone upside down again.
Get off the line, whoever you are, because I have to call Alex Jones to be on his show.
Dan, this is Alex Jones. Dan? Dan? So, Dan, how do you like my Dodge Stratus? As you can see on the dashboard, I have a special radar warning system to alert us when Obama's weather weapons are in the vicinity. China helicopters and airplanes moving tornadoes all around.
I drive slow in the driveway and all of those dings.
That's special.
I also got knowledge of the Illuminati and the occult especially.
Say, where's a good place in Newport to talk about conspiracies, Dan?
We could go to my apartment.
But we were just there 3 minutes ago when I picked you up.
Get off at this exit.
Wait, don't grab the steering wheel. After causing a serious five-car pileup, we're here in a ditch along the highway in Rhode Island talking conspiracies.
Officer Dan Bedondi from TruthRadioShow.com. Where in the Constitution does it say government can take over and occupy Texas?
Sir, your brain is literally hanging out of your ear right now from your car accident. How are you still talking?
Shall not be infringed. Shall not be infringed, officer.
Dan, this officer is clearly associated with the Bilderbergs, Raytheon, IBM, Bechtel, Agenda 21, microchips, gay-inducing juice boxes. Officer, are you a shapeshifter? Shifting lizard people from outer space?
Seriously, how is Mr. Bedondi still walking around with his brain leaking out of his head?
George Washington was a true conservative.
Next time on Crazies in Cars Getting Conspiracies, we'll talk to Texas Congressman Louie Gohmert.
Don't cast aspersions on my asparagus.
Be there.
The Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show.
I like shooting ski.
It is Thursday, June 25, 2015, and this is the Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show. I'm Bob Seska, and joining us today, sitting in for the vacationing Chez Pazienza, is my friend, the great Charles Johnson from Little Green Football. Charles!
Greetings!
All right. This is going to be so awesome. I cannot wait to get into some of the stuff happening with Chuck C. Johnson.
Yeah, Chez is having a lost weekend in Vegas, I guess.
Yeah, he totally is. Last night, Chez was tweeting from the Guy Fieri restaurant in Las Vegas.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
He's doing that Ray Milland thing.
Right. He's hitting Flavortown. He had the donkey sauce at the God. I can only imagine Chez's bowels right about now. I mean, it's got to be just a painful... awful ordeal. Wherever Chez and Taryn are staying, it's just they're just gulping down the Imodium like water.
Yeah, I shudder to think of the odor. So,
all right, we are we'll dive into the show here in just a second. We're brought to you by BubbleGenius.com. It's the best soap and bath and body products in the world. Also brought to you by the Bowen Law Group and attorney Charles J. Bowen. If you're getting sued by Chuck C. Johnson, better call Bo. Bowen Law Group wants to give you free answers to legal questions for our listeners only. Head over to thebowenlawgroup.com/Bob and Chez or click the link on the podcast page.
Okay. I might need to call him myself pretty soon.
Yes. Yeah. We announced that the other day on the show that it sounds like Chuck C. Johnson is going to come after you next. Is that true? Have you heard anything from him?
Well, he's been making noises to that effect. You know, who knows? It's after he loses the suit against Gawker, which right. He almost certainly will, mm-hmm. he might be kind of forced to rethink his strategy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who this lawyer is he has or whether or not he's paying this lawyer. I mean, I can only imagine that maybe the lawyer is on some sort of... Well, I mean, he would have to be on some sort of retainer, at least to start, and then...
I guess, but, you know, he's an ideological nutcase himself. He works with James O'Keefe and was a former Tea Party leader in St. Louis and, you know, was involved in some pretty far-right kinds of stuff, so...
Yeah.
Who knows? You know, he might even be just doing it pro bono.
So he's gone after Gawker over the pooping on the floor story. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so
not only that, and also some of the other grotesque rumors that Gawker printed about Chuck.
What is there's one now that I've only recently heard of, and maybe I'm out of the loop, or maybe it's new. What is the donkey one?
Oh, yeah. There's a rumor that he had sex with a donkey. So. Alleged sex with an alleged donkey. And then there's also another rumor about that he allegedly tricked his girlfriend into letting him pee in her mouth. Okay,
oh,
that was gross.
Oh, God. Well, you know what? I mean, they're all alleged. It's
allegedly.
But you know
totally.
What? I you know what? There's something about that that rings true. Hmm. So, in case you're just joining us, Chuck C. Johnson, not to be confused with the guy who's on the show here right now, Charles Johnson. Chuck C. Johnson is a hack fraud conservative blogger, and like I always say, I like to call him a conservative blogger because he always gets offended by that. Did you see there was a series of tweets, and maybe it was you who posted them, where he was going around and everyone who called him a conservative blogger, he corrected them on Twitter. There were like a dozen tweets where he went back and said, "I'm not a conservative blogger. I'm an award-winning journalist."
Yeah, he says that all the time. And then he'll turn around and say, all of us on the right need to do this or this. You know, so he just can't keep his story straight.
No, of course not. And Chuck C. Johnson, just by way of a little bit of background here, Chuck C. Johnson is really, his whole goal is the entire kind of disruption thing, right? Is that kind of how you peg him?
It seems to be. You know, I'm not sure. I get the impression it kind of stems from some sort of... psychological dysfunction. Disruption almost gives him more intention than I think he really has. I think he just literally can't help himself.
Right. Well, I mean, the thing that's interesting about Chuck C. Johnson is he's crazy. He's always wrong. He's at the same time kind of articulate when he speaks in, you know, in interviews and in public. He's not like a bungling idiot. Like, he's not like Alex Jones or Dan Badani, like we played here at the top of the show. He's not like this moron. I mean, he's clearly got some kind of brain in his head. It's just twisted. As we said last time we had you on the show, I mean, it's sociopathic. I mean, he's a sociopath, right?
Yeah, well, it certainly seems that way. I mean, one thing that a lot of people who've spoken to him say is that when they talk to him, he doesn't come across as any kind of nut. He's always very cordial and, you know, friendly and all this kind of stuff. And you know, that's kind of a mark of a sociopath. When they're speaking to someone that they think can help them in whatever their particular thing is at the moment, you know, they're extremely personable and nice and friendly and not crazy at all, you know. But then as soon as they get in the situation where they're dealing with someone that they see as their inferior or their enemy, boy, the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde thing comes out.
Yeah, I mean, you immediately imagine there being a clown suit in his crawl space or something, just something insane down there, bodies and weird torture devices. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, his MO has always been, and again, this is for the benefit of people listening in for the first time, his MO is to do things like outing alleged rape victims, doxing people who he perceives as being an enemy, just generally being wrong. And the one thing I always go back to, besides the outing of alleged rape victims, is the Marie Harf thing, which we touched upon a little bit the last time you were on the show, the State Department spokeswoman. Who he got, and this is what really made me scratch my head. Now, I don't understand what he does when he's outing and doxing these people. I don't grasp what he's trying to achieve there. But when he published that article about Marie Harf, I really questioned whether or not he's even a member of this planet. It was so, I mean, basically he was like tee-heeing over the fact that Marie Harf, apparently, when she was 16 years old, had toxic shock syndrome, which comes from, it's quite common and very deadly in some cases.
Well, she apparently almost died from it.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was laughing about it, making jokes, and not only on Twitter, he wrote a blog post about it too.
Yeah, and he was like, believe it or not, I can't believe this. I mean, he was just dumbfounded that this could possibly happen from a tampon. It's like he didn't even bother to like just go to Wikipedia and discover that it's a real thing, that it's a common thing, and that it's a potentially fatal thing.
Yeah,
and that just speaks to, I'm just gonna blurt. And I don't care if I'm wrong, because then I'm going to come up with some sort of twisted excuse, you know, sort of a Pee Wee Herman, I meant to do that.
Yeah, it's almost like an emotionally stunted person, you know, like he's 7 years old in his head.
And,
thinks that this stuff is funny, when really it's, you know, anyone who has even a modicum of empathy realizes, you know, you don't make fun of somebody for almost dying.
So what happened here, the latest story you've got at littlegreenfootballs.com, and by the way, thank you for carrying the podcast. It's so great to have your audience.
Oh, you're welcome.
But I mean, it's just, I mean, because I followed your stuff for a long, long time, and maybe in a little bit here we'll talk about when we first kind of met up online covering the Greenwald Snowden stuff. But I'm here on your site, and I notice here there's an article about Chuck Johnson getting thrown out of another event. Didn't he get thrown out of a Romney thing, or was it a McCain thing?
This was a Grover Norquist event, actually. Americans for Tax Reform, the guy who makes all the candidates sign an agreement that they'll never try to raise taxes.
Right, right.
Anyway, he said that he was invited by a friend to go to this event, but when he showed up, Norquist's director of outreach came up to him and basically said, you know, I don't think you're supposed to be here. Gather up your stuff. I think I'm going to be throwing you out now.
Oh, that is so great. Yeah, he's, you know, and the thing is he's not inconspicuous. You know, he's the sort of guy who kind of stands out in a crowd.
Definitely, yeah, and you know, he was thrown out of a John Boehner fundraiser back in March.
That's what I was trying to think of before.
And at the time, I kind of speculated that he had probably been put on a watch list by the Capitol Police because of what he did with Thad Cochran, where he actually went to Thad Cochran's house and took a picture of himself standing in front of it. The Capitol Police don't look on that kind of thing very kindly.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? It's funny. There's been this ongoing narrative among certain people on the right, most recently, of course, Chuck C. Johnson. But, I remember Michelle Malkin doing stuff like that. Like,
oh, sure, the countertop incident. Yeah.
Yeah, like showing up outside people's houses and just doing weird stalkery kind of things.
Yeah, well, Chuck has taken it to the next level.
Yeah, and then, of course, he did that to Twitter the other day and then tried to pretend like, oh, I wasn't taking my picture in front of Twitter. It was this restaurant.
Yeah, right.
Okay, sure, yeah, whatever.
He did it to me, too, as a matter of fact. You know about that, right?
I think you mentioned it to me on DM or something like that. But what exactly happened? He showed up outside your house or what?
There was actually – what he did was apparently he searched – for my name on one of these websites where you can, you know, look up information on people. And he found a previous address where I used to live years ago, like more than 10 years ago, in Pacific Palisades, California.
Yeah.
And it was an apartment house. And he went to the place and had his friend Peter Duke, the photographer, take pictures of him standing out in front of the apartment building holding a sign that said Obola.
Obola.
This was when the whole, Ebola thing was going on. And I guess I'm not sure what his point was, but it was clear that he was intending to intimidate me with this stuff. And he posted it. He posted it, the pictures on Twitter and said something like, here I am at the headquarters of Little Green Footballs.
Oh, my God. Right.
And so he obviously believed that I still lived there. And he was trying to intimidate me or scare me out of criticizing him by doing this, apparently.
Oh my God!
Unfortunately for him, is I didn't live there anymore, so
yeah,
he sort of beclowned himself in that way, and then also he didn't realize that I'm not the kind of person who easily scares by that kind of stuff.
I don't imagine. I mean, I was going to say, later in the show, you are one of the most tenacious people I've ever met, and that's definitely a good thing. I cannot imagine. If you ended up in the same room with Chuck C. Johnson at some point, and he tries to come over and sort of antagonize you in some way.
Oh, yeah. That would be an interesting moment, that's for sure.
I mean, I don't know where that would possibly be.
Well, it would never be any kind of violent thing. I'm not a violent person, but, I might have a few words to say to him.
yeah. But, I mean, what I don't understand is why... Ebola. That just doesn't make any sense. Like he maybe should bring like a meme, like something that you tweeted or something like that. But yeah. To go out there with Ebola, I mean, were you even covering the Ebola?
Well,
actually
I was. And I was calling him out on it a lot because at the time he was spreading all kinds of weird fear-mongering rumors about Ebola. claiming that people had been confirmed to have Ebola and it turned out they weren't. And if one of the people he outed, in fact, was one of the nurses who came down with Ebola in Texas. And he actually found her name and address and put it on his website. And he tried to do that with other Ebola victims as well.
God.
And
I mean,
at one point he posted a picture that was of the wrong person, claimed it was another nurse who was diagnosed with Ebola.
Well, that's right, because Chuck C. Johnson is always wrong.
Always wrong.
Always wrong. I mean, in fact, it's almost like that Seinfeld episode where George suddenly becomes the opposite of what he used to be, and then and then suddenly he's right. Chuck C. Johnson, what you read of Chuck C. Johnson, read it in sort of bizarro language, because then you'll actually see what the truth is if you just imagine the exact opposite of what he's saying to be true.
Yeah, I mean, the few times he has been right, it's mm-hmm. been something that he really shouldn't have been being right about. like naming that nurse, for instance, who came down with Ebola. He was right about that, but doing it was... just wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, a stopped watch is correct twice a day. So, I mean, it's bound to happen at some point. We're going to take a break and come back and get into the other Chuck C. Johnson story, which is also relatively brand new. Has to do with Obama and the N-word, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another good one.
We're going to take a break. Back with more show right after this.
I always wanted to be an internet journalist, but I kept failing. Then I learned how to abandon my integrity and sense of good judgment. And now I'm a real internet journalist. Thanks to the Chuck C. Johnson School of Hack Fraud Journalism!
That's right. At the Chuck C. Johnson School of Hack Fraud Journalism, you'll attend a series of informative courses based on the hack fraud journalism techniques perfected by hack fraud conservative blogger Chuck C. Johnson.
The Chuck C. Johnson School of Hack Fraud Journalism taught me how to publicly expose the names of rape victims.
I used to be a thoughtful writer who cared about accuracy. After attending the Chuck C. Johnson School of Hack Fraud Journalism, I'm a reckless asshole.
Accuracy in the mouth.
Enroll today and begin attending one of our many hack fraud journalism courses, such as The Facts 101, It's Good to Be Wrong All the Time. How to Get Your Readers to Pay You to Do Your Reporting for You. Doxing the Innocent. Slut Shaming the Innocent. Race Baiting and Gay Shaming is Totally Newsworthy. When in doubt, sue everyone. Chuck C. Johnson is a and so can you. Blurting stupid shit on Twitter. Clickbait is the only thing. Bio 10. You know what's funny? Toxic Shock Syndrome. Disruption Dungeon. And Toilet Habits 100. Go ahead and shit on that floor.
I shit all over the fucking floor, just like Chuck C. Johnson.
I'm shitting on the floor right now.
Tomorrow, I'm suing littlegreenfootballs.com for saying mean things about me on Twitter.
I'm suing a dead baby for libel. And is grieving inconsolable parents.
Right you are. Enroll today at the Chuck C. Johnson School of Hack Fraud Journalism. And for 10 easy tuition payments of $400,000, you too can learn from the master of hack fraud journalism, Chuck C. Johnson. Call 1-800-HACK-FRAUD and leave off the last D for head. Hack Fraud Chuck C. Johnson is not to be confused with good guy blogger Charles Johnson.
Hello, Bob here with this week's Bubble Genius Showcase item of the week. Go to bubblegenius.com and pick up their soft serve suds ice cream cone soap. serve up some ice cream with their 5-inch swirly cone soap in sweet vanilla. Looks exactly like a soft serve ice cream cone and smells delicious too. Only $7 at BubbleGenius.com, but if you use our promo code Bob and Chez, that's BobAndChez, you'll get 15% off your entire order only at BubbleGenius.com.
Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show.
Yep, welcome back to the show. This segment is brought to you by our Amazon link. If you want to go shopping at Amazon.com, go to the site using our link. It's just below the logo at BobSeska.com. What happens is it takes you right to the front page of Amazon.com. You go shopping and you save lots of money. Plus, you support the show because we get a teeny tiny commission from everything you buy. Okay, we're continuing on today with guest co-host Charles Johnson. And I always have to put that disclaimer every time you're not on the show, and every time I mention Chuck C. Johnson, got to throw that disclaimer in there. Now, is the fact that you kind of share a name, is that one of the sort of instigating aspects of you wanting to relentlessly discredit this guy?
Well, that's part of it, I guess. You know, he negatively affects my brand, you might say.
But also,
it's more than that. I mean, the guy is. He kind of made it real personal when he showed up outside where he thought I lived.
Obviously. I mean, if he showed up outside my house, I would have zero tolerance for that. I would pursue him to the ends of the earth because...
There you go. That's exactly the way I think.
Right, exactly. So now let's get to the next story here, which is Chuck C. Johnson, hack fraud Chuck C. Johnson, has been kind of really interested in a very creepy way into Barack Obama's personal life. I mean, not just like the birther stuff with the birth certificate and all that crap, but like he was accusing Obama of being gay, like a closeted homosexual. Right. And then this other thing is that he insists that at one point Barack Obama used called Deval Patrick, Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, the N-word.
Yeah, that actually came out when New York Magazine editor Abraham Reisman posted a series of tweets on June 19th. And I didn't actually see them when they were posted, but a friend of mine emailed and told me, hey, you should go look at this. I mean, this is something that sounds like you'd be interested in. And I looked at his tweets, and sure enough, he had a little story about Chuck. Apparently, he worked at the New York Sun in 2008 with Chuck before the election. And Chuck told him that he had videotape of Obama calling Deval Patrick the N-word.
Okay.
And not only that, Reisman also says that while Chuck told him about this video, he didn't say the N-word in quotes. He said the actual word over and over.
Really? Okay.
And Reisman described it as in a black scent.
In a black scent.
Yeah.
And was that Chuck C. Johnson's word? Or that's how Chuck
that's
C. Johnson described it?
Description of how he was saying the word.
And so what is it? It turned out that it wasn't that Chuck C. Johnson didn't see or didn't hear this audio, that it was like a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend.
Well, what actually happened then, Reisman got a call from Chuck. Apparently on Reisman's website, he has his phone number, which is probably not the best idea.
No, that's strange. Why would he do that?
But anyway, it's there. I went and I checked, and sure enough, it is there. And Chuck found it on his website and gave him a call. And then Reisman posted another series of tweets talking about the call from Chuck, who said that he called to clarify some things. And he said that he had no memory of Reisman, and he sort of remembers the conversation, although he said that he never actually saw the video himself. He said that a friend told him about it. And, in other words, he was just kind of changing all the details.
Right.
And then he told Reisman that the conversation might have been a prank that he was just pulling on a coworker. because he likes to joke around.
This guy is like, and he's like a bag full of monkeys, is what this guy's like. Good Lord.
And then on top of that, after all this was finished, mm-hmm. apparently Chuck told Abraham Reisman that he only saw the tweets that Reisman posted after I embedded them at Little Green Footballs.
Hmm.
But now there's a problem with that, too, because I also got an email from another person who sent me a screenshot of a Facebook post by Chuck C. Johnson. Now, he's got a Facebook account that's been made private, so, you know, you can't just go and look at it.
Yeah, we tried to troll. We were on our show last week. We tried to live troll Chuck C. Johnson, and we couldn't get to his Facebook page. But I added some choice comments on his website, including that bit that we play, the Chuck C. Johnson School of Journalism.
Who knows if he's even looking at it now? He seems to have just kind of abandoned the website. But
Really? I mean, he's not really updating gotnews.com?
There hasn't been anything new up there for, I'd say, 19 days now. I didn't check today, but yesterday it was 18 days. So.
Oh, my God. Why do you think that is? Is he so busy suing other people that he's decided to drop off? Or do you think he's...
Who knows? Somebody suggested to me that it might be because he was planning to say that he couldn't do that because of all the negative rumors to try to help his suit. In other words, to try to demonstrate that his livelihood was negatively impacted by all of the rumors.
I see. Okay.
That's a possibility, I guess, although it's kind of far-fetched. But everything about it is far-fetched. There was a postscript to this in that Reisman said that that Chuck told him that he only saw the tweets after I embedded them at Little Green Footballs. But someone sent me a screenshot from his Facebook page on June 19th, the day that Reisman posted his tweets about this so-called video. Chuck posted a link to one of Reisman's tweets and said, "So this is a lie." That was his comment about it. Now, my post only went up on June 23rd. So if Chuck posted this on June 19th, he was lying when he told Reisman that he only saw them after I embedded them.
Yeah, I mean, see, that's what he does that all. I mean, it's all lies. And what he does is he just self-exposes. He kind of self-debunks.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it seems like the reason why he would lie about this would be maybe to scare Reisman away from talking to me or colluding with me. Maybe he thought that we were colluding and he was hoping to intimidate him out of, you know, in other words, saying, you know, I posted them at Little Green Footballs and now I'm calling you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's a kind of another little intimidation game.
Right, well, you know, and I'm trying to figure out, I keep going back to the fact that he hasn't updated his website. I mean, that his blogging is basically, I mean, especially minus Twitter, his blogging is his power. And I don't understand what he intends to do by not.
I just went to it, and sure enough, nothing new today either. So it's now 19 days.
So weird. Well, okay, let's move on to some other news. We got some election news here. Just briefly, some brief election news. I guess the big clown car news today is that Bobby Jindal is now officially running, and I don't know if you saw his announcement speech, Charles, but it was predictably uncomfortable to listen to him speak.
Yeah, I actually watched part of it, but you know, my eyes start to glaze over, and I can only hit the stop button at that point. You know, but what was amazing to me was that I saw some people, I think Dinesh D'Souza posted a tweet saying, you know, look at how diverse the GOP field is, you know, and what do we have on the Democrat side? Just one white hag.
Yeah,
Hillary Clinton called her a hag. It's lovely.
Keeping it classy, Dinesh D'Souza, from his halfway house or wherever he is. here's a little bit of Bobby Jindal's announcement speech.
My name is Bobby Jindal. I am governor of the great state of Louisiana, and I am running for president of the greatest country in the world, the United States of America.
And one more thing. Great. 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 Great is great.
and everything's great. I'm in a great state, and it's in the greatest country in the great world, in the great universe, in the great galaxy. Everything's great. Yeah, Bobby Jindal. Yeah. This is going to be one, you know, again, I go back to sort of my broad point on the Republican clown car, and we have music for that, actually. No one likes this music, but so that's why that's my little contribution to the disruption effort. I play a song that no one likes. So the broad point here is that if everyone in the GOP is presidential material, then no one in the GOP is presidential material.
Oh yeah, well the clown car's getting awfully full.
Yeah,
but you know, I guess they can keep packing clowns in there forever. That's the nature of a clown car. You know, it's much bigger on the inside.
Yeah, I saw this news story come down just a couple of days ago, and it proved to me that Bobby Jindal, I mean, he's sort of like Kenneth the Page and all that crap, and he claims to be intellectual, even though he's a Rhodes Scholar, but he just denies all of these things based on science. But you know what? He's also a ghoul. I saw this news story the other day. Governor Bobby Jindal denies clemency to a man serving 13 years for possessing two joints.
Oh.
Bernard Noble, an individual serving 13 years for possessing two marijuana joints, applied for clemency and was recently denied by Jindal. The reason behind the denial was that he had not yet served 10 years in prison. Bernard's sentence is a prime example of the draconian nature of the marijuana laws in many states across the country. In stark contrast to Louisiana, many states have decriminalized possession of marijuana for personal use, with the offense being punishable by a fine and with no threat of jail time. This guy is wasting away. An entire decade because he had two effing joints. And Bobby,
that's pathetic.
Bobby Jindal would not grant clemency.
Well, you know, the real reason why he wouldn't grant clemency is because he's a Republican.
That's right. That's right.
So,
and he has, well, I mean, this is what he has to do, I guess, as part of that party. But at the same time, you know, have a heart, for God's sake. Two joints. It's not like he was going around selling them to children or, you know, blazing up and then, I don't know, getting behind the wheel of a car. I mean, it's two effing joints. My God.
Is this guy black?
Oh, yes.
Of course.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Naturally. Should have known.
Meanwhile, Chris Christie is about to announce. Chris Christie is going to announce his candidacy on Tuesday.
Boy, that's going to take up a lot of room in the clown car.
I know. Thank you for making that joke so I didn't have to. Send all your letters and email to Charles Johnson, care of Little Green Footballs. You fat shamer, you. No,
I know, I'm in for it now.
It's going to be Tuesday, and then it's just going to be one nonstop embarrassment for him. I hope, whenever I hear Chris Christie stepping out into public view, I hope he carries his ice cream cone with him. The funniest, you know what, there are some clips of video that occasionally I like to watch to get me psyched up to either write an article or to do this show. I love to go to that Chris Christie video of him on the boardwalk shouting down a passerby, and he's got that ice cream cone. For some reason, that makes me laugh and laugh and laugh that he's being such a dick, and at the same time, he's got the ice cream cone. So he's like just a big fat bully with his little yummy ice cream cone. Just it has to. I mean, it's the perfect accessory. You know, Chris Christie shouting at someone, and then he's got a tasty confection right there with him because he's always got to be within arm's reach. So Chris Christie,
that is hilarious. I've seen that video. It's great.
And possibly the scariest bit of clown car news here. And you know, Oliver Willis was actually thrilled about this, but I don't know. On Tuesday, we reported that Donald Trump was number two in the polls, in technically number three because number one is undecided. But among human beings, Trump was number two in New Hampshire.
Right.
In the most recent poll. Now he's number two nationally.
Yeah, I saw that today. That's really something. Of course, we're 500 days out from the election.
That's
still
true.
So.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, and these things often change. You know,
Bush is topping the list of GOP contenders with 15% supporting Republican primary voters. That's up from 12% last month, and his best showing yet. Support for Trump more than doubled since his announcement, and that catapults him up into the top tier at 11%. He's followed by retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson. Carson, the most dynamic speaker in the world at 10%. And no one else receives double-digit backing. Well, that's sad for all of them, especially like someone like Lindsey Graham.
I like shooting skeet.
Lindsey Graham likes shooting skeet. All right. We're going to take another break and come back with, maybe some Obamacare stuff right after this.
Imagine being surrounded by the spectacular scenery of Neverland while Peter Pan actually flies over your head. It's Peter Pan Live in the 360 Theater on stage now in Tysons Corner, Virginia. And because you listen to this podcast, you can enjoy this amazing experience for up to 50% off the regular ticket price. Just go now to peterpan360.com. And enter the code PETER to save up to 50% on up to 6 tickets, any performance. It's your only chance to see it in the D.C. area, so get your tickets today and get them for less. And by the way, tickets are now on sale for the upcoming shows in Houston, Texas. Go to peterpan360.com and enter the code PETER. Then prepare yourself and your family to be surrounded by the magic of Peter Pan Live in the 360 Theater.
Shove Bob and Chez into your pants and haul them around with you wherever you go.
Skeet.
Subscribe to the Bob and Chez Show in the podcast section on iTunes.
Yes, please do that. I've been slacking on the iTunes front. Go to iTunes. Even if you don't listen to the show on iTunes, go to iTunes and subscribe, and then toss in a 5-star rating and review. Really, really helps the show in the iTunes news and politics standing. Thank you very much. It pains me to see how many conservative podcasts are in the top 20. Need more liberal podcasts in there. So, and just by supporting the show, that helps us bump up a little bit higher in the standings there. And that the best thing though ever is the Chris Lavoie bump. The second best thing is the when people give us a 5-star rating and review at iTunes. Okay, so I guess the biggest news of the day, and we're kind of burying the lead a little bit here, is the Supreme Court upheld the subsidies for Obamacare, which is fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and it was a surprise decision. I thought for sure, Charles, that it was going to be a 5-4 thing like usual.
Well, luckily, they used some jiggery pokery to put it through.
Yeah, yeah.
You heard about that. That was Scalia's phrase.
Jiggery pokery. Yeah, Scalia had some hilarious words. I mean, Scalia, what is he? He's got to be like almost 90. I mean, he's out of his mind politically.
Oh, definitely.
But personally. I don't know what the hell is up with him. I mean, he wrote his dissenting decision, and it included, I mean, I've seen at least 2 different articles about this, all the weird things that he wrote in his dissent. Like he said, I'm looking at some of them here. Words no longer have meaning, he said. it was a lot of just like whining and crying like a little baby. I mean, it's just like, just this was Scalia's dissent basically whittled down to its essence.
He said it should now be called SCOTUS care.
SCOTUS care, right? Yep, I saw that. He said today's interpretation is not merely unnatural; it is unheard of. He also said this case requires us to decide whether someone who buys insurance on an exchange established by the secretary gets tax credits. You would think the answer would be obvious, so obvious there would hardly be a need for the Supreme Court to hear a case about it. As you mentioned, the funniest of the quotes was, the court's next big interpretive jiggery pokery. What in God's name is that? Jiggery pokery?
I actually looked it up at Merriam-Webster, and it means underhanded efforts.
So,
in other words, some kind of sneaky, underhanded efforts were done.
So basically, Scalia is dealing with like Victorian-era colloquialisms.
Yeah, you know, he was angry because they used underhanded methods like having it heard by the Supreme Court. That's pretty underhanded.
Scalia also has an imbalance of bodily humors. So he needs to take a tincture of opiates.
Yeah, and maybe he'll undergo some phrenology to make sure that he's he doesn't have any odd bumps on his head.
He called it pure applesauce.
applesauce.
Pure applesauce. Imagine what a university sends around a bulletin reminding every professor to take the interests of graduate students. You know, this is reminding me of a sort of ongoing plot thread in The West Wing, where one of the Supreme Court justices was writing his decisions in meter. This is actually kind of worse. And in that plot line in The West Wing, they actually tried to get that Supreme Court justice to retire because he was losing his bloody mind.
Yeah, it kind of looks that way for old Antonin there. He's his mind is going, I think.
Well, and I think if Hillary Clinton is elected, and I believe she will be, that it's going to be incumbent upon her to replace Scalia, because I don't see Scalia lasting that much longer. I mean, he's not, and I hate to sound morbid about a Supreme Court justice, but it is Scalia, so I don't mind all that much. He's not the healthiest guy in the world.
No, he definitely, he doesn't look too healthy these days.
All right, well, we're going to take one last break, and when we come back, we're going to get to know all about Charles Johnson from Little Green Footballs right after this.
You can't always get a clean you can feel good about inside and out, unless you're using Bubble Genius Bath and Body Products. See, Bubble Genius is a woman-owned small business proudly creating our vegan-friendly products in America and supporting other U.S. businesses by buying our ingredients and supplies from them as often as possible. Plus, you'll be hard-pressed to find packaging as recyclable as ours. Visit BubbleGenius.com and check out our cause-related items, too, like our global warming soap and a lot more. We donate our proceeds for those items to worthy causes, like organizations combating climate change and mountaintop removal mining. Good stuff like that. We also send our products to the troops overseas through our Buy a Soldier a Shower campaign. Because the least we can do is keep them smiling and smelling great, right? So visit BubbleGenius.com and feel good and clean. Bubble Genius, doing our part to make the world a better place, one bathtub at a time. That's BubbleGenius.com.
I know who this is. This is Stanley Clark, accompanied by Charles Johnson. This is the first album you played on. I don't know if you folks listening in, I don't know if you know this, but Charles Johnson, not just good guy blogger, but also an amazing effing musician. And that was I didn't know that about you until maybe several weeks into us doing the whole Snowden stuff a couple of years ago, and I ended up stumbling onto your Wikipedia page. I was like, holy crap. You have had an amazing career. I mean, just in music alone, you've worked with, of course, we just heard there, Stanley Clark, George Duke, Al Jarreau, Atlantic Starr, Otis Redding, for God's sake.
Yep, I've done a lot of work as a musician, that's for sure. I used to do a lot of session work here in L.A., but it's pretty much dried up to the point where there's only a few people still working in sessions.
Now is that because of digital? Is that sort of the
yeah, definitely. The digital thing and the way they can now do entire scores with just one person working with a computer. I mean, that's pretty much it's taken it really in a bad direction for live musicians.
Well, so now this universe of recording artists you played with, these aren't slouches. These aren't guys who, you know, have garage bands or who are just, you know, three power chords and verse chorus, solo, verse chorus. These are capital M musicians.
Oh, yeah.
How did you get to that point where you're playing with Stanley Clark and Jaco Pastorius and all of these amazing world-renowned jazz recording artists?
Well, Al Jarreau as well. I worked with him for a long time. Did a lot of touring with him. The way I originally broke in and ended up doing the Stanley Clark record was I was growing up in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And I actually had an acoustic band with myself, another acoustic guitar player, and a cellist. And this cellist happened to be the brother of Steve Kindler, who was the violinist for the Mahavishnu Orchestra at the time when they had that the version of the band with the string quartet.
Yeah.
And through him, I actually met some other people who were working in the band, and eventually I ended up meeting John McLaughlin.
Oh, my God.
And I used to go to John's house, and, you know, his he had a loft apartment in Greenwich Village, New York, and we used to go there and listen to him rehearse with Shakti. And that was quite a trip for some, you know, a kid from Hawaii.
Yeah, yeah.
And while I was doing that, I had made a demo tape of myself just playing solo acoustic guitar. And I gave it to John just to try to get it out there. And I didn't hear anything for a long time. Months went by. And then all of a sudden I got a call from John saying that Stanley Clark wanted him to play on his new album. Mm-hmm. But John at the time was in his sort of acoustic guitar purism phase. And he didn't want to play electric guitar.
Right.
And Stanley wanted him to play originally on Life is Just a Game. And since John didn't want to play electric, he recommended me for it. And so Stanley got in touch with me, and I sent him a tape, and he liked it. And then I auditioned for him, and he liked that. And next thing I knew, we were flying out to Los Angeles to record the album at A&M Studios.
Yeah, 1976 is School Days, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was quite a moment. My very first recording session in a major studio like that, and I was in the studio with Stanley Clark, Billy Cobham, George Duke, was the band. It was just incredible.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
Scary as hell.
I can't even imagine. I mean, you're going right from Maui to the big time. I mean, it was like there was very little sort of ascendancy there. You jumped right into it. So that must have been hugely intimidating and just tremendously stressful. I mean, were you able to, obviously you're extraordinarily talented with guitar. Did that sort of carry you past the nervousness? Because I would have completely seized up. I would just would not have been able to play.
Well, I mean, I guess it did because they didn't erase my parts. So I guess I managed to do it. And after that, I didn't get any work for about a year, which is the life of a musician. And I ended up moving from New York back to Los Angeles because I had some friends who were trying to tell me that, you know, the studio session scene was much more open here in Los Angeles. And at the time it was.
Right.
So I moved to Los Angeles just because I needed to get some work. And then I heard that George Duke was putting his band together. And he had a giant audition at his manager's office on Sunset Boulevard. And I think there must have been probably 200 guitar players at this audition. They were literally just lined up around the block.
Wow.
You know, with holding their guitars waiting to get in. And sure enough, I got the gig. So that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, and so you actually ended up working steadily from that point on, from like 1977 on through like the early 2000s. I mean, I'm looking at your discography here, and it's pretty much every year with just a couple of exceptions. Now, were you able to? And I'm so curious about this, and you don't have to be specific, obviously, but from these sessions, it looks like about most of the time about one or two a year. Were you able to earn a living? Because you were also, I mean, didn't you also tour as well?
Yeah, I was touring all through that time with George Duke, and I also toured with the band Hiroshima.
Yeah.
And Al Jarreau. I ended up touring with Al Jarreau, I guess, a total all told of about 7 or 8 years. And yeah, I guess with all of that together, you know, eventually you make a living. It wasn't a great living. Yeah. Now, I also was doing a lot of session work at the time for stuff that doesn't show up on the Wikipedia page.
Oh, I see.
I did a bunch of movies.
Like what were some of the movies? Like anything we'd know about?
There was a Richard Pryor movie.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and, you know, it's just mostly stuff that most people haven't heard of. And then I also did a bunch of advertisements for people like Greyhound Bus and,
oh my God,
you know, some local advertisers in Los Angeles.
So you were also writing too. I mean, so you were writing material for these, or did you just come in and play someone else's music?
Well, actually, I ended up co-writing one of the biggest hits that George Duke ever had, which was Reach For It.
Oh my God.
And
oh,
yeah, I still get residual checks from that.
Really? I mean, can you say how much like you get? I mean, that was 1977.
Well, I see, they're not huge at this point. But on the other hand, I did. They just licensed it to use it in Grand Theft Auto, the next edition of that game.
God. And well, get ready for the checks to get larger.
And it was also licensed for the Jimmy Kimmel Show.
Holy crap!
So I guess there seems to be renewed interest in the song recently for some reason.
Well, let's segue over to how you got started in blogging. You had you and your brother started sort of this computer coding thing, or was it web design, or how did you start up Little Green Football?
Well, actually, at the time, I was interested in computers and. Mm-hmm. I actually got an Atari 800 when I was not touring once because I was bored and I had nothing to do. So I thought, hey, I'm going to get this computer. I can play games on it if nothing else. And it came with a basic language cartridge. And I started to kind of get into that. And I found out that I had a kind of an aptitude for it. And, you know, ended up really getting into programming, and there was a point where I started a company with another guy named John Eidsvog that we called Codehead Software.
Wow.
And we made utilities for the Atari ST line of computers, and we were fairly successful at it. And I actually, at that point, I was writing in assembly language, which is pretty much the lowest level you can program at.
Yeah.
it's probably the most difficult type of programming. And so I've always been a computer programmer. And now when Al Jarreau stopped touring for a while, he took like a couple of years off. And at that point, all the work was drying up in Los Angeles because the digital revolution was happening.
Yeah.
And so I needed to do something else. So I started this company with my brother called Little Green Footballs. Web design. It was a web design company. We did a few sites and for people you probably never heard of.
But I mean, that was a pretty big deal at the time. That was 2001 or so. I mean, everyone was sort of. I mean, there was a big upswell. It was long before you could basically do a add water and serve WordPress site.
Right.
You know, a lot of people were looking for custom designed, you know, HTML and back end coding kind of sites, and so that was what you were doing.
And what I did was I wanted to learn about this new blogging thing. It wasn't even called blogging then. It was called weblogs. You know? So this is before the term blogging came in. Mm-hmm. And so I actually installed this software called Gray Matter, which was one of the very first blogging programs that was available. And just to learn about the technique and the technology, I set this up and started posting to this blog, and then 9/11 happened.
Yeah,
and that kind of hit me hard because I lived in Hawaii. I actually lived in New York when I was a kid.
Yeah,
so I felt a kind of connection to that, and and I started writing a lot about that, and I was really interested in learning about what drove the hijackers to do what they did. And
right.
So I focused a lot on radical Islam and, you know, the ideology and the figures who spread it. And I started writing a lot about that. And over the years, more and more people started coming to the blog because I guess I was as you say, relentless about it.
Yeah.
And, and I just kept at it. And then the thing that really got my blog through the stratosphere was the Dan Rather story.
Yeah. Yeah. And now, before we get into that, now, how would you describe your politics at the time? Because I think it's more nuanced than a lot of people assumed.
Well, you know, to be honest, when I started the blog, I was basically kind of apolitical for most of my life, although leaning liberal. You know, I voted Democrats for every presidential election before before 2004. That was the very first time I ever voted for a Republican for president. Mm-hmm. So I guess I was sort of leaning liberal, but more apolitical than anything. But what happened was, I guess because of the subject matter that I was writing about, I started attracting a whole lot of conservatives to the blog, you know. And at that point, you know, the software was pretty primitive. So the commenting section, again, you know, this is back in the early days. And at the time, I kind of thought that the best way to manage a commenting section like that would be to have as light a hand as possible.
Yeah.
Not to moderate, and then sort of trust the commenters to police themselves and keep the extremists out and all that.
Okay.
Yeah, I know it sounds pretty naive now, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, it doesn't work that way. I found out eventually. Uh-huh. LGF kind of got a reputation for having an extreme commenting section, and there was a point at which I had to look at it and realize, hey, wait a minute, you know, something has to be done here.
Yeah.
And there was a point at which I stopped using gray matter and ended up sitting down and just doing the work to write my own blogging software.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And when I did that, I started to be able to get a handle on how to moderate the comments better, because I could write my own tools to do it.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And so that's what LGF runs on now, is my own software. I don't use any of the, like, WordPress or any of the...
That's so rare. That doesn't happen anymore. Stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. I mean, and it's a slick site. I mean, the site actually works. I've never gone to Little Green Footballs and been like, why won't this load? Or why isn't that working? Or why is the style sheet all over the place or whatever? It's never had that problem. So that's a real hallmark.
I've worked on it an awful lot, you know, and I've learned a lot about, you know, how to make a site that can concurrently handle a whole lot of users all at once. You know, it's not a simple matter.
so let's talk about the Dan Rather thing, because that sort of rocket propelled you to national notoriety. I mean, that was a huge deal.
Yeah, it was. That was really something.
And it kind of ended Dan Rather's career, didn't it?
Well, it sort of did, although, you know, he still has a career, I guess, you know, but it definitely... It took him down from a pretty high pedestal there.
Yeah.
No, that wasn't my intention. You know, I wasn't really trying to take down anyone. I saw some documents that were fake, and I thought, wait a minute, you know, this can't stand. We can't, you know.
It had to do with George W. Bush and then Texas National Guard. Was that it?
Right. Basically, what happened was I saw a blog post that. Powerline blog.
Mm-hmm.
On I think it was the Thursday after the 60 Minutes 2, which aired on Wednesday nights, was on, and they were quoting a post that someone put at Free Republic by a guy named who used the name Buckhead.
Does that site even exist anymore? I haven't heard from the Freepers in a long time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's still there. Wow. Yeah. it's still there, just as extreme and weird as ever. So, you know, but this guy, Buckhead, had posted that, you know, someone needs to look at these documents that they showed on 60 Minutes last night, because the fonts don't look like typewriter fonts.
Yeah, from 1973.
So that kind of piqued my interest, because I've... you know, the company that I mentioned earlier, Codehead Software, one of the things we marketed were word processing programs and fonts. So I'd been involved in typefaces and fonts and layout and that sort of thing for many years. And so I got interested when someone said, these don't look like typewriter fonts.
Yeah.
And I went to the 60 Minutes website, and sure enough, they had the documents posted there.
Oh, my God.
And I downloaded the PDFs. Opened them up, and I knew instantly, the very second it appeared on the screen, that this was not anything that ever came out of a typewriter.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's just obvious if you know if you're used to looking at these kinds of things, I mean, it was incredibly obvious that this was not a typewriter.
And it was not just not a typewriter. It was actually like the default settings of Microsoft Word.
Exactly. And now that's when I really started to get chills, because what I did was I took one of the documents and I opened up Microsoft Word, and I just wanted to see how difficult it would be to duplicate this or to create something that looked like this. And so I just started typing with the default settings. I hit the tab a few times, moved over and put the date in where it was on the document, you know, and then I moved down a little bit, a few line feeds, and started typing. And as I was typing, you know, it has that auto word wrap, where as you get to the end of the line, it automatically wraps to the next line and breaks the line, puts the word on the next line. Mm-hmm. And as I was doing this, I'm watching on my screen, looking at this document right next to the Microsoft Word document, and I'm seeing the word wrap breaking exactly at the same point on down the screen for every line of the whole document.
And then you it's on your Wikipedia page. Charles is on Wikipedia as Charles Foster Johnson, and you've got an animated GIF, right?
What I did was originally what I did is I created a sort of an overlay where I made my screenshot of my Microsoft Word document and overlaid it on top of the Dan Rather document. And you could see that they were identical. So at that, then I realized maybe I should, if I make a sort of an animated GIF where I'm alternating between these two, it'll make it even more obvious. And that really did. That opened the floodgates, you might say.
Yeah, the floodgates in the intestinal region of everyone at CBS News, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, they stonewalled it for about a week, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're gonna, you know, we're way late on the show, but that's fine. This has all been great. I want to continue this conversation on what we do now for our Patreon supporters. It's called the Postmortem Show. So we'll continue the conversation then. But so this basically, you went public with all of this. You were blogging about this basically in real time as you went, right?
Right. That's right. Yeah.
And so, and you said it was, there was a brief period of time where they were stonewalling you, and then they finally had to respond, right? And so what did they denied it, didn't they? I think I remember Dan Rather just denying that.
Dan Rather still denies it.
Oh my God, he does?
Oh yeah, he's never admitted that the documents were fake.
What a shame. You know, I think
it's just obviously fake. I mean, one of the things that struck me about it from the very beginning was how it went through all these layers of editors at 60 Minutes, and none of these people saw that these were fake. I mean, that amazes me, because I knew instantly as soon as I saw it.
Now, did you think someone deliberately planted this document or delivered this document to CBS News as a fake, or was their source? You
know, I guess we'll never really know the answer to that. I mean, we do know that the guy who actually did it apparently supplied the documents to Mary Mapes, Dan Rather's producer.
All right, and she got fired. She was fired, right?
She got fired, and he apparently said that someone had given them to him, and he destroyed them. And, you know, basically it got all murky, and nobody at CBS was interested in following up or actually finding out what really happened, because, you know, there's no way they could come out of that looking good.
No, absolutely not. Now, see, that this is we're about to wrap up the show here, and we'll continue with the conversation on the postmortem. But I wanted to say that this is the kind of thing, that animated GIF that you made is the kind of thing I was just every day of the early days of the Snowden situation. I was dying for you to come out with some sort of evidence like that, showing that some of the PowerPoint documents were fake, or I was just like, come on, Charles, what are you doing?
Unfortunately, they were real.
All right, well, thank you, Charles, for being on the show this week, and we'll continue on the Postmortem Show. Everyone else, have a great weekend. Ches will be back on the After Party on Friday. Bye-bye.